Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. If you don't laugh, you'll cry, and I'd rather make you laugh, because if you don't, you'll die. And my very special guest today on the line, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is David Sarita. David, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's a little bit faint, but I can hear you.
How about I just turn the gain up on the mic? Is that better?
No, it's the same, but I can hear you.
Okay. Well, that's tolerable, I guess. Okay.
The question is, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Oh, good.
It's going
like
quite wonderful.
New Zealand accent.
Yes. See, the question is not whether or not you can hear me. It's whether or not you can understand the dialect. You know, somebody told me I had a funny accent once, and I thought I was funny because of my sharp wit, but I only just found out recently it's a speech impediment. Now, David, if you would indulge me and let us know a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, I do a lot of things, but I would say, you know, I grew up in the 1960s. I was born in 1961 in Canada, and our whole family moved to Berkeley during all the riots for the Vietnam War protests, and my dad is getting his PhD in psychology there, and started exploring the healing and super learning effects of deep relaxation and meditation at the University of California, Berkeley. So eventually, you know, his whole exploration of consciousness started wearing off on his four sons, and got us into doing yoga and meditation, you know, at the age of 13. But actually, when I was 7, walking home from elementary school, I saw a clear flying saucer. I mean, it was so clear. And I used to build model race cars. I used to build the Starship Enterprise models, you know, the Rebel model kits. And so I really knew aircraft and spacecraft, and I knew, you know, what I was looking at wasn't the Goodyear blimp. And people were in a pandemonium pointing up at this flying saucer. And, you know, when you see something like that at that age, I mean, in 1967 or 68, when that was, there's no such thing in my world as ufology. There's no such thing as, I mean, there wasn't any History Channel shows back then that were exploring the subject. It wasn't really even on TV. So it's quite something as an innocent, you know, kid to see something like that so close. And then in the following days, literally, my mom was in the middle of a divorce with my real father, and we moved into a new house in the Berkeley Hills with my new stepfather to be David Cooper, who was a science teacher. And so it was really, you know, it happened in this pivotal point of consciousness and science, and where I was going to be influenced by science from my new stepfather. And my experiences in that new house in the following week were that these beings from what we call the Pleiades, what they just showed me were these stars, the seven sisters, what we now call the seven sisters. They were showing me how their craft worked. They were showing me psychedelic like spinning in clockwise and counterclockwise on the same axis. They were completely human, but much bigger than we are, much taller, and different features. Their eyes are not the same as ours. And I really couldn't believe what was happening. In fact, one night, the babysitter, we had a babysitter in Berkeley because my mom was in this new romance, and we were, in the middle of the night, I was paralyzed. I went into what's known as sleep paralysis, and they were, it's not like abduction, like the gray aliens. They were completely human, but I was so uncomfortable with what was going on. I tried to scream, but I couldn't get control of my body. And it took a long, long time for me to say, okay, I don't know who you guys are and what this is all about, but this has got to stop. And I screamed so loud, and the babysitter came running down and grabbed me. And I just, from that point on, everything kind of stopped. But my whole life goes by, and it wasn't until the 1973-ish I saw on a TV station in Vancouver, Canada, where we moved again, back to be with our real father, Lynn Sarita. And, he was a hippie, you know, meditating, hanging out in Vancouver, going to nude beaches and things like that. And we were at this point raised with baseball. I was on baseball teams, and my stepfather was a science teacher, and bicycles and hot rods. So we go to live with our freaky psychologist dad again, and there's UFOs on the television, and it was the Billy Meyer story, how he was suddenly starting to see these flying saucers in Switzerland. And I said, oh my God, that's what I saw. And that was the same type of craft that was down low. Now, there were hundreds of witnesses that day who saw it, because it was down really low. And many, many years later, at a UFO convention, someone who worked at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, which sits right up on the hill above where we lived, said in 1972 they saw this guy approached me, and he worked at the lab that was known as the Space Lab. He said, we saw flying saucers out of the windows of the lab many times, and they were close. So I knew I had confirmation from another source, a scientific source, that the Berkeley area was being watched by these craft and these beings for a long time. And 72 is when Billy Meyer started having the ability to go public with his story in the early 70s. And there I was seeing it on TV, and I said, oh my God, you mean that there's other people who have seen these things? And so the door really opened. By the time I was 13, I was introduced to yoga and meditation and gurus from India by my father, and I started meditating every single day by the time I was 18. And, you know, I'm 52 today, and I've been meditating every day for over 33 years, doing all kinds of transpersonal, natural breathing techniques, deep relaxation meditation, brainwave studies. And it's utterly astounding. I mean, I can't even tell you how unbelievable it is to go on the path of meditation. No drugs, no plants. You know, I quit all those things in high school, which I tried very briefly for about 2 years. And had a lot of fun doing stuff like that, but, you know, and I'm really happy about marijuana trying to become legal, even though I'm not into it myself, because I get much higher meditating now at this point. So that's kind of where I came from. You know, that's
so do you get really hungry after you meditate as well? Do your your Dorito receptors?
You don't get the munchies. In fact, it's really funny because my wife and I, every night, okay, we want to watch this new latest movie flick, and I get so high. She's like, "Do you want to watch that movie?" And I'm so high from the meditating. I'm like, "No, I don't want to watch anything. This is too good." You know, you literally start to get that high. And there are numbers of gurus I've met. I'll name some of them. Like my first yogi that I ever met was a guy from India named Baba Haridas, who now lives in the mountains of Santa Cruz, California. And he's probably approaching 90 years old. And when I was 13 at this yoga retreat, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, I don't know what this stuff is. My dad was into all this. I was into baseball and hot rods. So, like, what is yoga and what is meditation? Well, in the middle of the night, I'm sleeping near the master's house in my tent. And my whole body, this energy, it's what they call kundalini, starts moving up my spine, but it's paralyzing me piece by piece. So my legs get paralyzed, then my hips are paralyzed, and I'm like, wow, what is this? It's almost kind of rumbling. And then all of a sudden, my arms are paralyzed, and I couldn't move them if I tried. This thing was so powerful, this force. And I thought, you know, just relax. I mean, I'm 13 years old, just relax. Let's see what happens. And I relax, and it actually is choking my neck. It goes up my neck, and I can't even think. And then all of a sudden, I'm in front of these three blinding beings of blue light. One is a woman with these beautiful jewels all over her third eye and her head, and a crown of jewels. And they're shining with all these psychedelic colors, and she's so beautiful. And there's a man next to her the same, and then there's this monkey god, you know, and I didn't know who the monkey god in India was. I mean, you know, I wasn't into this stuff. And they were shining with this blue light, and it was so powerful to look at them. I look at them and go, oh my God, they're like, they're gods. And they're standing in front of me. And so the next day, I go and I tell the master in front of a group of over 200, you know, yoga practitioners, and he laughs and he says, oh, that's Hanuman. And he has his disciple take me by the hand and go over and look at these Krishna paintings and you know, who this Hanuman guy was. And I go, oh, my God, that's who I met last night. And it turns out it's Hanuman, Rama, and Sita, these great Hindu gods. And I thought, how lucky could I have been? You know, people meditate, you know, they make prayers to them, and they have temples in India to Hanuman and Rama and Sita, which are incarnations of Krishna. And I'm like, I met them first right off the bat. So when I had that experience, it's kind of like, okay, this stuff is real. This stuff is fun. I want to know more. I want to start meditating more. But I still, you know, got influenced in early high school by, you know, pot and MDMA and cocaine I did once, and then I did mushrooms a lot. And I'm like, okay, this is fun. It makes me laugh. It gives me the munchies. And it actually helped. I would have to say the marijuana helped me cure my broken heart because, we lost our mom. Our mom sent us away to live with her dad, and she went to get a law degree, and we never saw her very much at all. And it ripped my heart to pieces, and I suffered from really serious levels of depression that were bordering on suicidal. And I became an extreme skier, a really crazy extreme skier in the 70s and 80s, and started jumping off, you know, huge cliffs and flying through moguls at, you know, 35 miles an hour. And I found that adrenaline-based highs were a good way for me to get beyond the pain by always staying in a high adrenaline state. And then I took up racing cycling in the summers in the city of Vancouver. You know, I was all into the super light frames, the Bob Jackson frame, and then going faster and faster and faster. And my brother Tim was skiing at over 120 miles an hour at Whistler, going down these avalanche chutes with his massive race skis. So we were all into adrenaline-based highs. And what I'm about to show you here is the difference between adrenaline-based highs and where meditation eventually goes, because it eventually goes into such cosmic proportions that it utterly dwarfs all of the highs that you get in adrenaline-based sports. So, you know, we're an adrenaline-based society. I mean, coffee, uppers, cocaine, speed, all these things to keep you so thrilled with super adrenaline so you can move super fast and work twice as hard as anybody ever worked in the 60s to pay off a house, and probably now about 100 times harder than anybody had to work back then to pay off a house. And then coffee, you know, just literally engulfs the world, so we're devouring rainforest to, like, buy the, you know, mega hectares to grow more and more coffee to keep everybody high on their adrenaline so they can do all this stuff and pay these banks these huge fictitious amounts of money that we invented that a house cost. So we went from the 1960s when, you know, my mom stayed at home and raised us, had plenty of time to be with us in the early days, to now most parents have to both be away. The kids don't have anybody watching them, and they're all getting ADD. They're not plugged into their heart chakras very deeply anymore because there's nobody really giving them love and nurturing because they got to work, you know, double jobs to pay for this number that we invented called a mortgage. So the adrenaline levels now in our culture are so ultra extreme. People are driving faster, driving crazier. You've got to burn. Like, remember in the 1950s and 60s, I remember when it was a big deal. Like, you know, you had your car for 20 years and you hit 100,000 miles. Now, you're going to hit 100,000 miles in 3 or 4 years. And what that does when you shift from relaxation, being in the heart chakra, blissing out in the 60s, everybody rebelled the government and they wanted free time. All the hippies said, you know, F off to you guys. We want to be free. We don't want to live in your society where we have to work like slaves. We want to have fun. So you went from that being a symbol, the number one symbol in a huge counterculture in America and Europe and Canada, to suddenly materialism and enormous increases in the cost of living to the point that we move away from bliss consciousness in the gurus. I mean, the gurus were coming, like the Maharishi was coming to America with the Beatles, and then you had Donovan you know, the great singer Donovan, who was really into the guru movement, and Ram Dass and Krishna Dass and all these guys that were hanging around with Neem Karoli Baba in India, they were bringing this concept of meditation to the West that said, hey, you know, it's really fun to drop acid, but it's way more fun to hang out with these gurus because they're transmitting this huge amount of consciousness and you get really high, like seriously blissed out when you really hang out with some of these heavyweight masters.
Well, David, we have a break coming. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, folks. My very special guest, David Sarita. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I hope you get something really, really true from me and the guests that we have on this radio program. I suppose if we weren't telling you the truth, we'd probably be getting paid a shockingly large amount more money. My very special guest is David Sarita. David, are you currently in Canada?
Yeah, I'm back in Canada. We just left Sedona, where we were for 6 years, and we're up in Canada.
So previously you were Sarita in Sedona?
Yeah.
All right. I gotcha. Now, it's summertime in New Zealand here, so I hope that you're feeling the warmth all the way up there. It's not too cold, is it?
No, I got my heater on. We got a fireplace going here. We're sitting right on a lake in the Kootenays.
That sounds really majestic.
There's some hot springs nearby if I need to warm up. So
that sounds really majestic.
Yeah, it's really majestic. It's a beautiful, pristine place. And one of the reasons I moved here is because I've developed this new tuning transmitter technology, which we'll go into, and how to actually accelerate meditation and vibrate yourself, your energetic self, with the frequencies of another star system or another planet somewhere so you can astral project there. But where I was kind of going is, you know, how, I mean, everybody likes to get high naturally or whatever ways, and we have a million different ways that we try to do it. We all have different things that we really groove into and get us naturally high. For some of us, it's sports, and, you know, for me, it was for a long time, it was extreme skiing, and then I took up skydiving. I've got 300 skydives. I've jumped from 35,000 feet and done 300 miles an hour, you know, opening my parachute and all that stuff. And it's a lot of fun. Those things are fun. You know, what I'm saying about meditation and where it goes, it's not that you think, okay, those things are a waste of time. I look at those things as kind of a, you know, part of the path to getting over fear about being limited to just the body. And adrenaline, you know, energetic adrenaline, if you look at the chakra system in the body, you've got 7 energy centers in the body that correspond to glandular chemical centers in the body from the base of the spine. Then you have your sex center. Then you have your adrenaline-based center is the 3rd chakra. So when you, above the 3rd chakra is the heart chakra, then the throat chakra, then the 3rd eye, the inner eye, and then the super million lotus petal flower chakra on the crown at the top of the head, which is where the major ecstasy levels come in when that chakra lights up. So most of our culture is in the 3rd, you know, 1st to 3rd chakra, you know, sexual based highs that go into, you know, adrenaline, and when you're really deeply in love with somebody, you can really get blissed out in the heart chakra. But So that's kind of the extent of our culture. But when you look at deep mysticism and deep mystics, it took me a long time meditating every day, you know, doing deep breathing meditations, doing yoga, doing all kinds of pranayama, which are breath control exercises, you know, and some years go by where it's just kind of peaceful. You feel really peaceful after you meditate, but there's not any serious levels of ecstasy there. And it wasn't really until I started applying myself more. Like, I took my same extreme personality type that I had when I was an extreme skier and a skydiver and applied myself to meditating as much as 7 hours a day, sitting and holding this posture for an hour, taking a break and sitting and holding this posture. And then I went to these 10-day Buddhist retreats where you're meditating 10 hours a day for 10 days in a row, and that's when it really started to hit me how unbelievably high you can get, and it's long-lasting. It's not like something that just hits you for a few hours and goes away. I mean, some of these highs are so velvety, so cosmic, and so the bliss is so perfect that it's not like an adrenaline-based high where you eventually want to calm down because you're getting the jitters. You know,
could I ask?
I thought, you know, I am a thrill-seeker type personality, so if there's no really good high in this meditation stuff, I quit. You know, I don't want to do this and cross my legs my whole life and stare at my third eye just because someday I'm going to get supposed enlightenment. So I was approaching meditation.
I was going to ask you a question. If I may.
Yeah.
What is the difference between somebody who meditates for hours to get high and somebody who just shoots heroin and gets really high for hours?
Well, the difference in the quality of the high is enormously different. I mean, there's no sickness in the high you're going to get from meditation. There's no nausea. There's no throwing up like I got with mushrooms. There's no... The depth of the bliss and the ecstasy and the peace is so much deeper. And I've gotten this argument with so many people who are drug addicts, and they say, oh, no, you've never done this one, man. No, you haven't done this. And I'm like, you know what? I did enough to know that, and I can clearly see when I look at people who are on those type of highs, I look at them while they're on it, and I'm like, you're nowhere near what I'm talking about that's really possible through meditation, but it's okay. It's a lot of work to do the meditation. You know, you can't get a black belt in Kung Fu just sitting around and blowing circles in the air. You've got to apply yourself, and it takes about 7-8 years of meditating daily to get good at it. And there are a lot of techniques that don't work, like for Western people. They don't really work. And it wasn't until, actually, that I found my soulmate, my wife, Crystal, that I was able to really get so much love in the body that, because a lot of my experiences in the early days were out of body. You know, for example, and this is quite extreme. I mean, most of my practice became hardcore Buddhist Vipassana meditation, long, long hours of sitting. And in 1986, December 21st, which is solstice, you know, that's, you know, when the sun is going to start it ends its journey and it's about to start its new journey for a new year. December 22nd, I got this shaky feeling in my body. I was living in Vancouver, Canada. It was pouring rain, and I started to, like, shake. I thought I was coming apart at the seams. I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I went, whoa, man, go lie down. This is, like, there's something strange going on here. And I didn't know it was Kundalini at the time. I thought maybe I was having a nervous breakdown, but for no reason. And I lie down at 4:15 in the afternoon. Within minutes, I'm out of body in this perfectly clear crystal vision of an old man who's lying in the poorest of the most poor houses. He's got torn wallpaper on the walls, you know, pots and pans that are really cheap that he does his cooking with. And it's a shack. And there's two women in white robes praying over this dying man. And I approach him. And he gets up, and I thought, he's alive, and he's pale, and he says, do you want to see an angel? And I said, well, why, yes. And the second I said yes, there was this deafening. It's like thunder beyond a million times louder than earthly thunder. And the sky tore open and this blinding light starts shining down. And the most astounding voices of angels, the highest, most beautiful notes, ripping the vision to pieces. And there was so much power coming from this light. I collapsed on the ground, and these two women collapsed on the ground. And this old man was an enlightened master. And we are lying on the ground, and the sound is deafening of the angels. I mean, there's so many beautiful notes. It's like Handel's Messiah times a million. And I'm lying on the ground. There's no ecstasy. It's just pure, the fear of God and the angels and the power and the light. I'm shaking and shaking and shaking, and I'm aware of my body on the bed. And I'm becoming paralyzed piece by piece, just like I did when I was 13, you know, in the yoga retreat. And then it goes, my arms become paralyzed. I couldn't move them if I tried. And the sound in the room, I could have opened my eyes. It was deafening, the sound of the angels' voices. And it went up my neck, and I literally felt like someone was choking me. And instantly, when I relaxed into the neck, suddenly, it's like I was dead, and all I could hear was the deafening sound of angels, and nothing but the fear and the terror of God was in me. I didn't feel any bliss. And suddenly, there was an explosion of ecstasy that started in my belly that was like a supernova of ecstasy. It dwarfed all previous levels of ecstasy I'd ever known. And this ecstasy just exploded like a bomb, and I went flying up above the city of Vancouver, above the rain clouds. I went above the earth in this light, in this blinding ecstasy, and there was a glowing being off to my left, whom I guess was the angel, that, you know, the master that was dying in the bed. And then I saw hundreds of thousands of deceased souls in these silvery gray cocoons that were about the size of a human aura. They're like the shape of an egg. And it's interesting to note in near-death experiences, when people see they're going through the tunnel, they describe the walls as silvery gray. And inside of the cocoons, I could see movies. Like, you know, when you're thinking of an apple or an orange or some kind of fantasy is going on in your head, you're projecting it against your own little movie screen around your energy field. You're actually seeing the imagery with your eyes closed. And all of these deceased souls were dreaming what they had done in their life, but they didn't realize that none of it was real. They were in this kind of matrix where they were all only 2 or 3 inches apart, hundreds of thousands of them. And I was in this blinding ecstasy. I mean, the ecstasy levels were probably a million times greater than the best natural ecstasy in meditation or love or sex or anything I'd ever experienced on Earth. And it was sustained. It didn't stop. The ecstasy and the love didn't stop. And the angel singing was still deafening. So all that was happening, and then I came up to one of the eggs, and it started to shake and tremble. It was afraid, just like my body had to shake and tremble, and my ego, or, you know, the ego, the small self, had to crack open to get out into this super cosmic light. And the angel said, they're not ready. They're going to reincarnate. He said, they're not ready to live in the super light realm. They're too afraid, so they're just going to go through their life review process on their dreaming screens, and then they're going to learn the lessons that they needed to learn before they go into another incarnation, somewhere in the universe, not necessarily Earth. So then I sped through towards the center of the galaxy with this super light, and I approached a membrane that kind of looked like glass. And as I got close to the membrane, the ecstasy was so bright, it was crushing me. I was like, God, stop, This is too much ecstasy. I had no idea there was that much ecstasy in the universe. And I pierced the membrane and I went into the second heaven, which was instantly a million times more crystal clear than the first, instantly a million times more ecstasy and love and peace than the first heaven. And I was told there are millions of paradise planets suspended within this heaven, which is actually in our galaxy. And then I sped through that heaven, and I went to the third heaven, where everything multiplies another million times. And I said, oh, my God, I had no idea there was this much ecstasy in the universe, this much love, this much peace, this much beauty. And it doesn't stop for a second. you actually have to get used to living in that much love and ecstasy and bliss all day long. And then I went to the fourth, and when I went into the fourth, it was the end of having a human form. I became a giant star, and there was the ecstasy levels there begin to become unspeakably huge. I mean, they're so far beyond my wildest dreams in the fourth. There's no way to even speak about it. Any drug experience is like, you know, so cheap compared to this. There's nothing that can touch this. And then I went to the fifth and the sixth, which are utterly unimaginable, simply unimaginable, that is the human potential for enlightenment. And I saw the seventh, and the seventh was so massive. I said, God, you can't take me any further. I can't take this. It's too bright. There's too much. It's too overwhelming how much there is here. And then instantly, I had this desire that if I cross the seventh, I will not be able to come back and tell people that there really are seven heavens. There really are unimaginable dimensions to the kingdom of heaven and paradise, and I'll just die. My body will terminate on the bed. And I instantly woke up. All of the ecstasy was gone, like somebody turned out the brightest light in the universe. And the next day at 4:15, it all happened again. Now, when you have an experience like that, you come out of it and you come into the world and you go, oh my God, like we are living, I hate to say it, but in the most suffering, there's so much suffering here that it's like, how did that much light, how does it exist at the same time and we're in this? How is it possible that we don't get to experience? If everyone on the planet was lifted to the first level, there'd be no violence, there'd be no war, there'd be no lack of abundance anywhere.
Well, then the military-industrial complex wouldn't be able to make a living.
They would be so blissed out of their mind on love and ecstasy. The difficult thing in these realms is it's impossible to be violent.
Welcome back, everybody, and welcome back to my very special guest, David Sarita. David, I don't think you have shared your web address yet. Have you got one?
Yeah, my website is lightdreamtechnologies.com. That's lightdreamtechnologies.com is where my harmonic transmitters and my supercharged pendants are, and my movies are at voiceentertainment.net. I love that last song you put on, You Might As Well Be Walking on the Sun, because, you know, beings like Dante Alighieri, Emanuel Swedenborg, and many others, like Pythagoras, the great mathematician, experienced in meditation. Pythagoras traveled to the sun, and he found that it is inhabited by super-astral beings that used to live on Earth, and so are the rest of the nine planets on different frequency levels. All the nine planets have different beings living on them who have attained different levels of consciousness. And so, you know, we look out into the universe, and NASA looks out into the universe with this idea that there are going to be somebody else out there that's vibrating physically at the same frequency as us. And surprisingly, they can't find anybody anywhere. And they think, well, you know, we're physical, we're real, and if there's anybody else out there, we're going to bump into them. And this is where it gets really amazing. You know, for me, it's like, you know, I grew up in the 60s, followed all the Apollo missions, always wanted to be an astronaut. And the closest I got into physical space travel was skydiving, you know, jumping out of planes. And while it's a lot of fun, it doesn't compare to what eventually starts happening when, you know, I get deeper and deeper into the UFO phenomena. I'm lecturing all over the country on flying saucers and UFOs. I made a movie called Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs, that was released in 2000. That kind of put me in a national radio spotlight when Dan Aykroyd did a cameo introduction to the movie. And I proved that the space shuttle was using cameras, video cameras, that could see very, very low, super weak levels of light. And that's where these unidentified flying objects seem to appear. Now, the UFO I saw in Berkeley in 1968, after about 20 minutes of everybody watching it, at least 30 or 40 people were just in that neighborhood alone in Albany, right next to Berkeley, it just blinked out. It went into another dimension. It physically didn't accelerate like an aircraft would. It just jumped dimensions. And that is a problem that has beckoned me since my childhood. I never, ever stopped thinking about the flying saucer incident. And I'm the kind of person who, you know, doesn't just take cheap modern science as the satisfactory answer to the UFO phenomena. You know, I kind of laugh at university-level physicists and scientists who, most of whom have never really built very much technology in their lifetimes. And a lot of them who have theories that are wonderful on paper, but don't really work very well in the real universe. And so, while the whole world seems to mostly trust them, that they would tell us if there were contact happening on this planet, having seen a flying saucer with my own eyes, not on a video camera, not on YouTube, there's a lot of fake footage on YouTube, when you have your own experiences, there's nothing more golden than that. And I started, you know, I started tree planting when I was 18, about 18 or 19 about, and I planted over 1 million trees, so I was doing my karma yoga work, and I actually loved tree planting. It was very peaceful, made me physically very, very strong, very powerful. Didn't make enough money to buy a house doing it or even to pay all my rent, but I really enjoyed doing it for all those years. I worked in landmine and bomb detection. I worked in nuclear fusion. I directed the Tesla Foundation in Los Angeles and spoke in Congress on non-radioactive nuclear energy and worked for a panel of brilliant physicists for years. So I kind of got into the science under the influence, I guess, of my stepfather, David Cooper, that science and spirituality were going to be, you know, the two doors that I would eventually try to merge. And then I started making movies because there were all these PhD university scientists and physicists that were working on the problem of consciousness at Princeton University, you know, like the Global Consciousness Project, headed by Dr. Roger Nelson at Princeton, and Gary Schwartz and many others. And I made this film called The Voice, my first film where I shift from flying saucers. I did a movie with Dan Aykroyd called Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, and then I went on to consciousness. And I really wanted to come back to consciousness because the reason SETI, using radio telescopes, couldn't make contact with another star system, seemed to me that the problem lies in our ability to sense using sensor technology was so limited and so dead that there was nothing more sensitive as a sensor than living DNA, living beings. And when aura cameras were invented and you could see that plants had auras and people had auras and animals and mammals had auras, it was very exciting to know that we weren't just chemistry. We were actually alive with light, and that light could be the answer. The light that emanated from physical living tissue could be the answer to receiving signals that were very, very valid, because where else where we, you know, and where we assemble consciousness ultimately, even now on the radio, it's You're listening to voices that are traveling at the speed of light through a network, a radio network or an internet network, but it's all assembling back into consciousness in your brain, in your heart, in your feelings. And the thing that consciousness has as an advantage as a sensor over electromagnetic sensors and, you know, strong and weak and gravitic sensors is that physics really only knows four or five major forces that it can sense. The consciousness has the ability to sense far more than that. Far more than that. And so what started to happen very quickly, you can Google this, is that scientists started to, in consciousness, like Fritz Albert Popp in Germany, a good physicist, standard physicist, proved that plants and humans and all living things that are energetic fields, our auras, were transmitting faster than light signals. Faster than the speed of light. And the only thing that could do it was living tissue. And that really excited me. I said, well, if living tissue and DNA, it turns out Fritz Albert Popp discovered that it was the DNA in the center of the cell that was actually the transmitter receiver for these faster light signals, that you could actually use it interfaced with a transistor, which is a piece of quartz crystal and layers of, you know, gold and metal, which amplifies all the signals in your computer. And then you have crystal oscillators that are very similar to transistors, but they're about tuning frequency. That if you interface that with DNA, you would have a far more advanced sensor. And that's what they're doing. You can Google DNA transistors and oscillators, and you'll find out that that's where artificial intelligence, that's where the new level of sensing is going. Because sensors that are, electronic sensors that are connected to living DNA have this super advantage in that they can receive and send faster than light signals. And the big giant radio telescopes, you know, albeit very impressive looking, like in the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, can't seem to find out that there's anybody else in the universe but us. And, you know, what a waste if we're the only ones here. And if no one's watching the universe, it isn't happening. Because if consciousness is not there to perceive it, all that beauty, all that color, all that ecstasy coming from the stars, then it's useless, because if there's nobody perceiving it, it isn't really even happening. And physics eventually started to go in the direction that they found when they did these explosions, these subatomic particle explosions in the early days. You know, Niels Bohr comes to Einstein and says, and Heisenberg comes to Einstein, and they say, this was at the, you know, I'm trying to remember the name of the conference, the conference, these great conferences that were convened every year in Europe. They said, it looks like the minds of the researchers are affecting the results of the experiments. And they said that this can't be happening, but it looks like it is. We have to remove the observer from the observed while we're taking the photos of the subatomic particles, because it's messing it up. And that really was a conundrum that really disturbed mainstream quantum physicists. In fact, even to this day, the most popular names in quantum physics will not admit that it's happening. But the best names in quantum physics in the early days knew it was happening. In fact, Einstein becomes so mystified by it, he literally believes, and so does Max Planck, who's really the godfather of the quantum movement and the protege mentor to Einstein. They really realized that, oh my God, the universe is alive and it's conscious.
I do think that we're entering into a new phase of discovery where we're capable of realizing that there are worlds within worlds within worlds, rings within rings, as they say. And some people try to deny that everything that they believe currently even exists at all. They've lost themselves, and as a result, they decide to deny anything else that contradicts their own disbelief in reality. We'll be right back after the break with David Sarita on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.